Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2018, and you're listening to episode 89 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Benjamin Shaw. Ben Shaw has a Master of Arts in Religious Studies and is currently a PhD candidate in theology. He has delivered lectures and essays at various universities, including the University of Virginia, and he has been a graduate assistant for Dr. Gary Habermas for the past 5 years. In the 2018 Volume 41, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Ben has co-written with Gary Habermas a feature article, and it's called "The Historical Uniqueness of Jesus Christ Among the Founders of the World's Major Religions." Ben, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you've co-written this article with Gary, and I noted that you've been an assistant of his for the last 5 years. And so what made you decide to write on this specific topic? As I recall, it was a paper that you guys had given at the Evangelical Theological Society convention last year in 2017.
Yes, Dr. Habermas had given this this as an academic paper. He presented it, and it was well received. So we wanted to make this into an article that people could read and get in their hands and just start to look at some of these historical aspects regarding world religions from a comparative view with Christianity. And I know he's been interested in world religions. You know, when he was going through his periods of doubt, a lot of people have heard him say, you know, how he was interested in Buddhism or things of that nature. Ultimately, it was the resurrection that helped lead him out of that direction, and some of the other truth claims that Christianity makes and actually has strong evidences for. And for myself, I grew up in South Florida, which is a pretty big melting pot down there. And I was actually a bit of a pluralist and a relativist for a while myself, and just kind of thought everyone went to their own heaven and just had some kind of odd views, but didn't have a lot of people I felt really too comfortable talking about with those issues. And it wasn't until I started listening to guys like Ravi Zacharias that I started being just like blown away by the fact that people think about these issues on a deeper level than I was, or even any of my friends might have been. And so then I started looking at these issues in a little more detail. And I actually, that's what part of the reason why I had changed. I was to a Master of Arts and Religious Studies in my master's program, and was able to study these subjects in much greater depth, especially from theological points of view and philosophical points of view, and also the evidential points of view. Just getting to see what it is that distinguishes these world religions from Christianity. What is it about Christianity that distinguishes itself, and why should we believe one over the other? Are all these claims just the same? And all sorts of questions like that. And it was just really exciting, actually, that after having done that study, that's what kept me going to the PhD program.
Well, I know whenever we post an article that we've done in the past about are all religions equally valid on social media, places like Facebook, we just get so many shares and likes, because this is a question that still very much interests people, both Christians and people who are not Christians. They will say, especially people who are non-Christians would say, well, all religions are the same. They all teach the golden rule. Jesus was a really good teacher. And so, you know, I think this podcast will be a good exploration specifically of different religions for our listeners. And so what are some of the key themes that Jesus taught that other religious founders of other religions did not teach?
Yeah, so that's an excellent place to start. Obviously, Jesus has been very unique and the most important figure in the Western culture and the development of the West. And what is it about him that makes him so unique? And just to pick three things: his claims to have a unique relationship with God, to be deity, evidenced, for example, in the Gospels, Mark 14:62, where Jesus is at the trial and they're asking Jesus, you know, who are you? Who is it that you are? Just tell us so we can, you know if you're the Savior we want to know. And Jesus says that he is the Son of Man who you see will see sitting at the right hand of power. And it was just a reference to Daniel. And the priest at that time immediately recognized that as a blasphemous claim to make Jesus out to be the Son of Man coming in the clouds of power. And so that was immediately recognized as an exalted type claim. You also see that much more explicitly in John 10:30, for example, where he says, I and the Father are one. And, you know, I recall watching a dialogue between two people from two different worldviews. And the one person was questioning whether or not Jesus claimed to be deity. And this verse was brought up. And the response back was, oh, well, Jesus is just claiming to be one with God there. Is that really a claim to be deity? And the person responded back, could you say that? And the answer was no. I couldn't say something like that without believing that I was God. So I thought that was kind of a really just interesting modern day example of how that text was used to help identify Jesus's deity. And of course, you got Paul and Philippians 2, where there's a famous Christ hymn in 2:5-11 in Philippians, where Jesus is just in the form of God and coming down to serve us, to serve mankind, not because we're so great, but because God is just showing his love by taking on the form of man. And just those claims there are just emphatic, emphatically different claims than you see from other world religions or worldviews. I typically like the phrase worldviews better, just as a side note there, just because it helps kind of take out some of the fangs or stigmatisms that might be associated. Some other claims Jesus made were his offers of forgiveness and sins and a special relationship with God that are found within himself, rather than pointing towards some path for others to follow or rather than pointing to someone else. So in Mark 8:35, you see Jesus saying, whoever takes up his cross and follows me, whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's sake will save it. So you see Jesus has a unique identity there. And also this is a third thing that he does that's also going to combine the forgiveness. But Jesus also performed miracles, which were important and served an authenticating function of who he was. So he validates his ability to forgive, for example, in Mark 2, where he heals the paralytic. But first he says that his sins are forgiven. And everyone was wondering, does he have the authority to do this kind of thing? That's the prerogative of God to do something like that. And Jesus affirms that by raising him and healing him so that he's able to walk. So these miracles, which, by the way, virtually all critical scholars will acknowledge that Jesus was a miracle worker. How they nuance that is going to vary scholar to scholar, but they acknowledge that he was believed to be an exorcist, a miracle worker. And of course, the resurrection, for example, in 8:31, where Jesus predicts that he's going to be raised from the dead as part of his mission and what he came to accomplish. So those are just kind of three things there, I think, are really help Jesus stand out as someone in history who demands at least our an honest look into who he was, and was he who he said he was.
Well, I just want to take some time to go over various different worldviews compared to Christianity. And one I would like you to talk to us about is giving us some of the historical evidence for the teachings and beliefs of Hinduism. And, you know, probably, you know, there's quite a few Hindus in the world. It's the second most populous country in the world, and there's more than 1 billion people there, and like 80% of them are Hindu there. So there's quite a few Hindus in this world. And as, you know, we've become a more cosmopolitan area, there's a few Hindu temples where I am in Charlotte. And, you know, the local Indian takeout restaurant that I go to, they have, you know, flyers for their local temple for people to join them. And actually at the doctor's office, one of the nurses invited me to go to attend her local Hindu temple. And so there's a lot of Hindus even in America. So I guess We're not all familiar with Hinduism, so why don't you kind of give us some historical evidence for their teachings and beliefs, and are they similar to Christianity or not?
Yes, that's a good question. I've actually had similar experiences too, especially when I've worked in DC a little bit. I'd run into quite a bit of Hindus and Buddhists in that area. And actually, just a quick side note here, speaking of our backgrounds, I've always enjoyed martial arts. And, you know, like I was saying, when I was growing up in Florida, Buddhism and meditation, and those were big things with some of the martial arts that I was studying at those times. So we can encounter different worldviews and beliefs in all sorts of different areas, whether it's takeout or whether it's martial arts. So it's definitely an important thing to do and to know. So in these situations, and especially in our article, we really tried to identify more specifically, not so much the beliefs and teachings, but we really wanted to identify the historical components of these religion or worldviews rather. And so for Hinduism we looked at perhaps the best and well-known text for Hindu beliefs is the Bhagavad Gita. And this is a story where Krishna, who's one of the Hindu gods, takes on an avatar and has a discussion and conversation with Arjuna. And Arjuna's in this really tough situation where a battle's about to go on, and he's worried because he's got to pick sides. And no matter what side he picks, no matter what decision he makes, it's going to be a tough one, and it's not a good one. So that's kind of the story that goes on. And the battle that's depicted here is believed to have been about 5,000 years ago, so around 3,000 BC. Some scholars date to 3139 BC, but we could just say we're going to use round numbers in our discussion just to keep it simple and keep things, you know, fairly as straightforward as possible, but with the understanding that there's some flexibility here. So roughly 3,000 BC. So that's when this battle is believed to have occurred. And now I should put a little footnote here too, is there's debate even within Hinduism as to whether or not this account is even supposed to be historical, or is it just an account that is something that conveys truths? So that's not really where our article was going after, but those are good things to just keep in mind as far as the theological and philosophical beliefs for Hinduism. So this battle is believed to have taken place around 3000 BC. Now, the Bhagavad Gita itself was included into a larger canon of scripture. So the Hindus have a number of beliefs, but we just wanted to pick what we believe to be the most popular, most famous, most respected is. The Bhagavad Gita was incorporated into what is known the Mahabharata, which is another collection of writings, which has its own development. The Mahabharata has been referred to as an evolving encyclopedia, where interpolations are not viewed as a bad thing, but as a way of enhancing the text. So that's quite a distinction from Christianity, where interpolations are definitely not something that are looked on with smiling faces. So just a little footnote there on that part. But it wasn't included into this text until much later. And they think it's that it was written between 450 BC all the way to 700 AD. So that's a wide gap on when they believe it was written, just there, especially now when we're taking into account that if it's talking about events that occurred around 3000 BC, if the text did not come into its written form and arrange from 450 BC to 700 AD, that's a huge gap. So it's very important that those are things we want to just take into account when we're doing this this worldview historical checklist, if you will. So that's when they think the text was written, between 450 BC to 700 AD, and the scholars will kind of debate those numbers. But the earliest text we have doesn't even come until the 12th century. So these numbers present huge historical gaps. So if the events occurred around 3000, we don't get the writing until 450 to 700 AD, and then we don't have our earliest text until the 12th century, the gaps there are just enormous. We're not talking decades or centuries, but millennia. So that's quite an important thing to consider when we're looking at the historical or evidential value of, say, the Bhagavad Gita.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Benjamin Shaw, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Ben has written a feature article with Gary Habermas called "The Historical Uniqueness of Jesus Christ Among the Founders of the World's Major Religions," and you won't want to miss reading this. And also in this issue, you will not want to miss out on reading articles about training teens in apologetics and our evaluation of the HBO series Westworld. So to read his article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe online, please go to our website, equip.org. Well, earlier you were mentioning growing up in South Florida and also Buddhism, being aware of that. And I also want to mention to our listeners that way back in the maybe mid-1990s, which was some time ago, but these actual teachings don't change dramatically, we did a multi-part series on various forms of Buddhism. So that's available free on our website. We have articles about Zen Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism up there. But what about the historical evidence for the teachings and the beliefs of Buddhism in comparison with Christianity?
Yes, that's a great, just topic to just engage in. And there's an interesting uniqueness with Buddha. There was a recent article that was put out in the Journal of History and Theory where a scholar named James Ketelaar was doing a historical survey of the dates for Buddha of when he lived. And he finds that the scale is, it's almost so big in a sense, it's hard for us to nail, like to fathom. And the gaps he finds are that the dates of Buddha's birth vary by over 2,000 years. So that's significant. And I think that's something that I certainly, for example, when I was in South Florida, I wouldn't have known that. I wouldn't have known those things, that scholars can debate such a wide range there. And even still, like when you read that, you're like, man, that's a big gap, but it's so big, I almost lose a grasp on what that may mean. Well, in his article, Ketelaar uses the example of like if this were Jesus, it would be like saying he lived sometime between Socrates and Descartes, which is just a massive difference. If you can help allow that example to be a good analogy. Now, just because there's a 2,000-year discrepancy on where scholars put it, that doesn't mean that scholars don't have either a consensus or maybe some idea or general idea of when he was born. Generally, 563 to 483 BC is a good year. Edwin Yamuchi, who's an excellent scholar out of the University of Miami, Ohio, that is. He uses 563 to 483 BC. And those tend to be some reasonable dates that scholars have put forward. So when we look at the text, though, what did Buddha say? Because what Buddha said is important, because if he achieved enlightenment and he's trying to teach others to follow that same path to enlightenment, well, we need to know what path he took. And so we want to know if the words that we have now are what he was teaching. So when we go and look at these texts, there's a Sanskrit canon, but that text wasn't written until about the first or second century AD. So if we just use even numbers again, we'll say 500 BC for Buddha. And now we're looking at the first and second century. We're looking at about 600-700 years on the Sanskrit canon. Now there is an earlier canon, the Pali canon, and that one can date to the first century BC. And there may be even some sections that get as early as 2 centuries after Buddha, but we're still looking 2 centuries-year-old information and whether or not that has been passed on accurately. So the gap then that we're looking at is going to be 500 to, the Pali canon was, that scholars are thinking it has been written down to about the first century BC, with maybe some portions going back to just 2 centuries after Buddha. But the problem is there's so much later material wrapped in with what may possibly be authentic material, scholars don't have a way to get that authentic material out. So that's an interesting date difference there that we see, and different challenges there, where In Hinduism, the historicity of the event isn't quite so as important as the teachings may be. But here with Buddha, we want to make sure that we're on this path to enlightenment and we're doing what he was saying because he was the one who had attained it. So I think it's that presents a unique historical challenge of itself.
You guys also mention in your article Zoroastrianism, and I don't know that that's a religion or a worldview that people run into very often. So could you kind of unpack that belief system, that worldview for us?
Yes. Zoroastrianism is a much smaller worldview by comparison. It's not held by quite so many people today, although it is it's considered to be a very ancient worldview. Going back to now, like Buddha, it runs into some challenges as far as when this worldview came into being with Zoroaster, and his dates vary. They're not as bad as Buddha's. They only vary by 1,000 years. So instead of 2,000, we're getting 1,000 here. So they believe he was from either 500 BC to 1500 BC. So we've got a big gap still, but most scholars are placing him closer to the 500 and 600 BC. And most notably, you'll see a lot of interaction of Zoroastrianism with the Persians. And so that's where you see a lot of the texts and discussions tend to focus around. At times. Now, the texts that Zoroastrians will use is typically the Avesta, which is, that's their canon, if you want to put it that way, although there are many different texts. Now, within the Avesta itself, the earliest portion is believed to be the Gathas. Those are just the earliest the earliest portions of the Avesta collection of writings. But the mass and most heavily theological as far as the beginnings of the universe and what's going to happen at the eschaton, those are found in the Pallavi texts. And those they're not believed to have been written until about the 9th century AD. So the Avesta itself might have circulated earlier, but probably did not get its written form until the 6th century. But the important and central theological beliefs were not composed until the 9th century AD. So here, as with Hinduism and Buddhism, we have a date, and in this case, it's, we'll just say, about 500 to 600, so say 600 BC. We've got the writings that come in 500 to 800 AD. So again, we're looking at a 1,000-year to 1,300-year gap between the events and the writings that we have. And you know, that's on the more conservative side, because if you take the 1500 year date for Zoroastrianism, then you're going to get 2000 to 2300. So again, we got another significant gap there. And for those who will be interested, we go into these details in the article, and there's references there too for them to further dig in and look at the historical information regarding each of these three worldviews.
Well, finally, what about some of the historical evidence for the teachings and belief of Christianity? And do you feel that Christians are constantly put on the defensive regarding the evidence for the claims of their own worldview compared to the other religions?
Yes, those are two good questions. Let's start with just what some of the historical evidence for, say, Christianity and Jesus. As far as the gap goes, Habermas is well known for his timeline argument. And that argument, we can do a real short in about 20 seconds here. His argument is essentially that if we're going to say Jesus, the two main dates given for Jesus' death are 30 or 33 AD. We'll just say 30 to keep it easy math, and that's the majority view anyway. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 that he gave information that he had received. In Galatians 1 and 2, he says he traveled to Jerusalem and met with Peter and James just 3 years after his own conversion, and he interviewed them, maybe a good word to use there for historesi, and that's Galatians 1. And the information that Paul delivered to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 15 was what most scholars believe to have been given to Paul in Galatians. But if Paul got it in when he went to Jerusalem, as reported in Galatians, then that material must have come earlier. And you've got scholars like James Dunn saying that came within months of the crucifixion. So what's very incredible about Christianity, and this is within the ancient world, not just as far as Christianity as a worldview, we've got Jesus's death at 30 AD. We've got Paul reporting a quote that in this early creed in 1 Corinthians 15, information that is derived months after Jesus's death. So that's one unique component. The New Testament itself, as far as it goes, and again, it's a collection of writings. It's not just one author, but if we just look at the Gospels, for example, they were written about, and this is critical scholars will agree to this. This isn't specifically, you need to have a conservative Christian holding to have this, but about 40 to 70 years after Jesus's life. So a very short time. And that's there's Jewish scholars who hold that, agnostic scholars that will take those dates. Those are just kind of the general dates. There are some scholars that date it even earlier. I know there's, for example, there's some scholars that date Mark within the 40s. So that's pretty early if you want to go those ways. But if you just want to stay safe, you can do the 40 to 70 years, which, again, is pretty early. And especially early in compared to the evidence we've seen for some of these other worldviews. And it should be, I guess, kept in mind, too. Secular history, if we want to call it that, they also have challenges. So Alexander the Great's biographies come centuries after his life and after the events in his life. So those are important things to keep in mind as well. As far as just the dating of the Gospels, not to mention Paul's writings, which come even earlier than the Gospels. We also have early fragments of the New Testament. Perhaps best known is P52, which is the Rylands Papyri, which dates to the early to mid second century. And you've got guys like Bart Ehrman, who's probably one of the best known agnostic / atheist scholars, at least in America. He's saying that we've got far more manuscripts than for the New Testament than any other ancient writing. So again, that's pretty incredible. And then you've got other scholars who make, some other scholars really make the point. For example, John A.T. Robinson says that the historical questions that are asked of Christianity are not the same types of questions that a Hindu would ask the Gita, or a Muslim would ask the Quran, or a Jew of the Old Testament. They're just so much information there that we can ask these more critical questions. And so I think it's kind of like a backhanded compliment to be able to ask and investigate all these different issues and get into them, because we can engage them. Because you can't, to use a sports analogy, if I don't have the equipment to play hockey, well, I can't even get on the ice. Well, Christianity has the equipment, so it's able to get in the game and participate, and we can have these discussions. And that's one of the challenges, actually, of digging into some of the historical evidence for some of the other worldviews, is because it's tough to find research on that material. It's tough to find firm dates and things like that on those, on either the founders or the texts themselves. So I think that's a very unique component of Christianity. It's an exciting component of Christianity. It should give believers confidence and boldness, but also grace, because these are questions that people are used to asking Christianity. And we should, in a sense, expect such questions for Christianity, because we should expect the questions, one, because people don't just want to, like Proverbs says, we don't want to make a promise and then ask, is it holy? Did I rush into this? Like, is this even holy what I've promised? They're good questions to ask, and we should be asking them. So I don't think there's anything wrong with people asking them. Christians should be very graceful when those questions are asked, because if we weren't believers, we should have the same questions too. And of course, Christ was, he suffered, so we should expect to suffer. And I don't really think, we might say, oh, well, getting asked questions isn't necessarily suffering. Certainly not, and I would agree to that. But if people start asking in a more skeptical tone or things like that, again, that we should just be happy to answer the questions and address them, and to do our best to do so. But I would add this: when they ask them of us, we should also have the concern to ask those questions back of them. And whether, and that's, any worldview that is. So if you feel like you're getting peppered as a Christian with certain questions, feel free to answer them to the best of your ability. And if you don't know something, say you don't know and go and do some research. But at the same time, don't forget to ask questions of the worldview of the person that you're dialoguing with. For example, today I was talking to one of my friends, and I was sharing with him how I had been in a discussion once I was excited to speak with this skeptic because he was pretty well known, and I got an opportunity to do it. And I just asked, I was like, what are some positive reasons that I should be an atheist? What are some positive ones? And we talked for a couple hours and I couldn't get one reason. So when you start getting into those discussions, you can get into those and see, okay, well, they have no positive reasons, or they have these reasons. What are Christianity's reasons and how do they stack up comparatively?
Well, you've mentioned a lot of research and dates and different facts about various worldviews, but how do these positive evidences finally that you've talked about with Christianity, bottom line, how do they help or impact the life of just the average Christian?
Yes, that's like where the rubber meets the road. It's kind of like when I finished my master's thesis and I told my wife, she said it in total love. And, I told her, I was like, hey, I think this, like, this is great evidence for Christianity. And she's like, okay, great. Now what? Like, what are you going to do with that? How is that going to make a difference? You have this belief, and what are you going to do with it? And once we have when we start having these evidences that we can rest on, that should help us not waver as Christians in various ways. It should give us this confidence, one, in witnessing, that we know we're sharing the truth and we're not just making these things up, but they're things that we believe, and we're not pulling them out of thin air, but we've got these reasons to believe them. And they should also help us too. And if you guys are familiar with Habermas's work on doubt, he does a lot of stuff on doubt, which is excellent. And I highly recommend that. But the apologetics here, or these reasons for the hope that we have, should help us when we're going through these questions of doubt. And doubt can take many different forms. And oftentimes for example, if we're in temptation, or maybe we're in depression, and we're saying things to ourselves that's not true. I just use my own example, myself as an example here. I remember when I was starting to study some of these other issues, and I was wondering, is Christianity really true? And Jesus's resurrection, I couldn't get out of that. And that would kept bringing me back to Christianity and the truth of Christ and the things he taught, because I couldn't escape the reality of his resurrection. So in ways, when we go out into the real world, we're going to be confronted with different challenges. And whether that's maybe in business, and we're confronted with a deal we know is not going to be the moral one. It may be the better one, but it may not be the moral one. And we've got to ask ourselves, it's easy to say, man, maybe God, we almost know it's a lie, but we'll say things to ourselves like, well, maybe God doesn't care about this, or, this is just a small thing. It's no big deal. God's not going to punish me for this, or he's unconcerned. But then when you recall back to things like the resurrection, he sacrificed his own son. Like, our lives are important to him. He does care about us, and he wants us to reflect that care to others as well. So those are important outworkings. Depression would be another one, for example. It's really easy when something bad happens, and it's easy to go, man, God doesn't love me. God doesn't care about me. And those are just lies that we tell ourselves, and they're not true. And we need to remind ourselves of those things. And that's where the truth of God essentially can ground us to reality in the midst of what can appear chaotic situations around us. For example, the loss of a job, I may, have all these issues where I'm wondering, the worries of the world, so to speak, can overtake us. But keeping grounded in the truths of Christianity can help us navigate through those times of chaos, temptation, or whatever the case may be. So that's, to me, that's one of the greatest things that Christianity, as far as the positive evidences, can provide, and just grounding us and recalling us and constantly glorifying God with our thoughts and meditating on his truths and things of that nature.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Ben. So, Ben, apples or oranges?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm from Florida, so I want to say oranges. But it's been apples lately for me.
So, are you an introvert or extrovert?
Oh, that's such a good question. My wife's going to say I'm extroverted, but I'd say introverted. Oh, that's such a tiptoe answer.
And so, do you prefer calling or texting?
Oh, texting.
And are you an early bird or a night owl?
Night. That's a very clear night owl is the answer there.
Well, thanks, Ben, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I was very, very happy to do it, very excited, and look forward to hopefully this article will engage a lot of readers.
Today's guest is Benjamin Shaw, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, he has written a feature article with Gary Habermas called The Historical Uniqueness of Jesus Christ Among the Founders of the World's Major Religions. To read this article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe, go to our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes. And when you rate and review our podcast, it helps others to find our content. So please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888 Ask Hank, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged. It's Hank's new audio podcast. You'll follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.